This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll talk about Big Blue coming to the Red Stick. Adam Knapp of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber is slated to be with us to discuss this major endeavor that is slated to take place at the site of the location where the Advocate used to be. Also on the show, we will hear from Emily Zober, Baton Rouge attorney, about pro bono services in our community. And Marina Adshade, her book is Dollars and Sex, How Economics Influences Sex and Love. Call it Sexonomics from Marina Adshade. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside our area. The number to dial, 877-217-5757. You may also reach us via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Hope you're having a good Friday. And we begin with Adam Knapp, who is president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber of Commerce. And it's been a big week for Adam and the Chamber. Headline in yesterday's newspaper, IBM selects BR. A $55 million planned IBM office and residential complex will be right on the Mississippi River at the former Advocate location. And it's to be 8 stories tall with residential space, and including 95 apartments and 9 townhomes. Well, good morning to you, Mr. Adam Knapp.
Good morning to you. Good Friday.
Good Friday. And it's, as I said, it's been a good week for you. How did this come about?
Our staff has been working with the state for, goodness, probably 2 years now, if we go back to some of the earliest conversations with IBM, on an idea of what it would look like to put a services center in Baton Rouge. And the company has gone through a lot of discussions, a lot of review. They did a request for information search process last year that really developed the full concept of the project that's now been announced. And our team, working with the state and a lot of other partners, LSU and the Baton Rouge Area Foundation, and a number of even private companies who helped us tell the company about, you know, hiring IT workers and computer science folks in our market. And so a lot of folks helped play a role in this. We have been thrilled with the company's response, obviously, and their genuine enthusiasm at the announcement was just so exciting for so many people to see what they have come to find out about our community that we've known for a long time, but they have validated with this announcement. That's probably one of the most exciting parts of this announcement.
How significant was the involvement from the Baton Rouge Area Foundation and commercial properties?
It's an enormous piece of this. At one point in the project, Jim, we were looking at existing spaces that were available, and they fit the company's interest, but you could tell that it was, you know, lukewarm interest to a permanent solution for what they were interested in. And the conversation started with the foundation about what it would look like to build something that was a landmark facility, that would be something that was a long-term solution for them, something that was visible, but also represents the sort of the scale and the importance of this project to Baton Rouge. And that's where the project idea came about. And the foundation and the folks at Commercial Properties really jumped in quickly. Within a matter of days, they had the first rendering once the first conversations happened, and their turnaround was something that the company really jumped all over and saw that this was a great idea and one that they were excited to have a part of.
We're hearing the voice of Adam Knapp, president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber. Next month, as in a few days from now, he'll celebrate his fifth year as the head of the chamber and start year number 6. Now, Governor Jindal says the state will contribute $14 million over 10 years for faculty and recruiting for computer services at the state's flagship university. This is in partnership with IBM, and certainly that had something to do, I'm sure, with IBM selecting Baton Rouge. How much did the city and the state have to give to get IBM? Was it was the store given away?
No, we're going to get a great return on investment. You know, we run an economic model for every project that we are involved in from the Baton Rouge Area Chamber side, and our model we vet through third party sources, but it's an economic impact model. And when we look at let's take the city parish return on investment for a moment. They're gonna invest somewhere between $3 and $4.5 million, $3 million in the facility, and an additional $1.5 million in temporary space and relocation services with the company for people and other things. When that is all said and done, on 5 years, they'll be seeing a return, and we see on a 10-year basis somewhere in the neighborhood of a $16 million return just to the city parish coffers for their investment. So the project is a huge home run financially. Obviously, it's a signature project that we are one that we are excited about for Baton Rouge. The state will be better to articulate their return, but we know that their numbers look great. The other great thing about how it's structured as an incentive, we always want to make sure that the protection to the taxpayer is there. There are clawback provisions mm-hmm. in the agreement that make sure that the lease secures the company to their commitment, and they've got a corporate lease standing behind the agreement to be here for the period necessary to see the return on investment.
It's going to be situated on hallowed ground for many journalists who've toiled in the vineyards of journalism in this community. It's going to be at the site of the Old Advocate, isn't it?
It is. It's a. As you will probably know, and others in the community, the long history of that site. The site is one that's incredibly visible from the river, and right in the heart of the community. And some of the renderings, for those who have had a chance to go online and see some of the renderings, there's one that is my favorite, which is a view as if you're coming over the bridge, and you can see the IBM Blue logo on the top of the building with the Capitol in the background behind it. And it's just a beautiful sort of vantage point, but it shows what the site that the Advocate had was just a phenomenal site, and is right at the heart of the redevelopment of downtown Baton Rouge. So in proximity to it, you have the Crest Building redevelopment that's right there. You have a number of state government facilities. Mm-hmm. You have the Hilton Hotel a block away, the Indigo, the new Hampton Inn that's going in, very close to it. So there's a really great mix of things that are right there within a block or two from that site, restaurants and retail that are expected to come as well.
Well, it is a significant development, and it's one that should be saluted, and the Baton Rouge Advocate and its main editorial today does exactly that. Big blue and red stick, and it is something that will be a nice addition to downtown. That's kind of an eyesore right now. How long will it take to complete the project?
The expectation is that the building is completed within 3 years, and that the we should be seeing the progress of that by the end of this year. That the design work and a lot of the other pieces will begin to move forward, and we'll all be hearing more about that. Mm-hmm. I would love to mention, Jim, that while the building is moving forward, the company is also going to be moving into hiring very quickly, and I want to make sure early on in this to mention the job fairs that are happening very soon on this. So if you don't mind, I want to just highlight a little bit of that. This on April 23rd at the Baton Rouge Marriott off of College, the first full job fair, big job fair, is going to be happening for IBM from 10 o'clock a.m. to 8 p.m. We're encouraging folks to not only attend it, but to go online and register. They can submit both their resume or just register to attend the job fair. The website for that is IBMLouisiana.com/jobs.
IBMLouisiana.com/jobs.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And they also outline that they're going to be visiting in the weeks before that, between April 8th and April 19th. They're going to be visiting campuses around the state to really gin up the recruiting effort at not only LSU, which we've talked a lot about. They're going to be at Patrick F. Taylor Hall on April 11th in the evening. But they're also planning visits to Southeastern, to Southern University, to UL Lafayette, to the University of New Orleans, and other colleges around the state. So they really are jumping out of the gate in April to visit all of our colleges to mm-hmm. spend a lot of time looking for recruits. And, we're encouraging all listeners to not only go to the website, find out more if they're interested, if their family, friends, brethren are interested, their children are interested. It's a great time to get involved in sort of seeking a career here at a great company.
All right. Now, we had a listener say that you said 3 years. The Advocate yesterday reported it would be completed by the spring of 2015. That's 2 years. You obviously know what you're talking about.
Well, I misspoke. You're right. It was the Advocate timeline. I was leaving room that there's time for weather delays and everything else, but our assumption is that they're right on their timeline.
All right, 600 construction jobs. How many jobs when the project is completed?
So the total project of 800 jobs is the company's commitment. Their indication of the size of the project is one that we have talked about in the last couple of days. It's going to be a scale up over the next few years as they're building toward that 800 job target. So it's going to be a number of years as they're ramping up, but they will have a significant number of their hires coming in as quickly as possible, and that's what we are thrilled about. And with these outreach efforts, is that they're starting the process for identifying talent, training them, and getting them into their company as soon as possible. When they're at 800 jobs at the full scale of the company, which is the full economic impact of this model is based upon those numbers. Their estimate was to be in the range of salary ranges in the neighborhood of $50,000, roughly average, which is something that we think is a very conservative target for where they can hit that number. But these are good-paying jobs with careers with a global company, which is exciting.
297-5633 if you'd like to join the Good Friday conversation with Adam Knapp, president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber. Almost 5 years on the job. He succeeded Stephen Moray, who is, of course, the Economic Development Secretary, and he deserves some credit, a lot of credit for this achievement.
He absolutely does. Yeah, the leadership at the department, and you'll hear a lot of folks in the business of economic development say this, this has been a secretary and a staff who have been some of the most top-notch that we've seen, and the company specifically called them out numerous times, not only in private but in public, for the quality of their interaction, the thoroughness of their involvement, and the breadth of the thinking about how to approach a project of this scale.
Well, Stephen Moray has had some significant achievements, and that's one department I'm sure the governor is quite proud of. But this announcement, which is significant, has been overshadowed about the conjecture regarding the governor's sales tax proposal. Is the Baton Rouge Area Chamber going to take a position on this?
We will. We have been putting this to a tax committee to spend a lot of time thoroughly walking through the details. As many others have commented, pieces of this have changed along the way, as they have recently. And so we've continue to work through a tax committee of folks that know more than I can profess to know about taxes in Louisiana or in the country, and they've been doing a lot of work to understand the transfer of an income tax model to a consumption-based sales tax model, and the various moving parts around taxation of services as an expansion of the sales tax base to services. And so they're really doing that work for us and our board, and they've been bringing updates to us along the way. When we get closer to session or into session is when we'll have we expect a full feel for where what the plan is and its impacts, and we're going to spend more time talking about it at that point.
Last night after the 6 o'clock news on television stations across the state and on radio stations too, the announcement was made from the administration that the proposed sales tax rate is now 6.25%, up from 5.88%, a significant change that was announced on Holy Thursday before the Easter weekend. And we will talk with Adam Knapp about IBM and much more. Go to the phone lines when we return. 297-5633 is your number. Back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster's show at WRKF.org works online. And Adam Knapp is our guest for a bit longer, the president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber of Commerce. Jim on Highland. Jim, good morning to you.
Hello?
Yes, Jim, you're on the air.
Adam, I want to congratulate you, Steve Moray, and John Davies and organizations for what you've done. And my question is very intricate in that now that you've landed such a wonderful high-tech company hiring our youngest and our brightest, what do you see that this opens up for us in the future to bring these type companies here to keep our students that are excelling in education and encouraging them to come to this community?
Boy, that's a great question. There's a lot of pieces there. First, in terms of economic development work, our perspective is that we have been on a rising trajectory with a series of companies, really going back to 2008. And when 2008, when EA Sports came to the South Campus of LSU, as it was known at the time, and started building their facility. EA, of course, is the global leader in game development applications, and now are located on the main campus at LSU in the top floor of the Louisiana Digital Media Center. And when that project was announced, we said that this is the beginning of a trend that we think will many, many companies, small and large, will follow to both grow here and be attracted here. And we heard from companies like Trace Security. Pete Stewart over there told us that he was already finding from his clients that having the EA name in Baton Rouge was giving confidence to his business partners around the country and globally, that they saw that his ability to compete in Louisiana and in Baton Rouge was improved by having a name attached to the community he was from. Think about the effect then of IBM on the same type of thing for our existing companies that are in the technology space and for other companies that now have seen and national news sources that IBM selected Baton Rouge over so many places around the country that have deep bench talent in computer science and software engineering, and that they saw the opportunity to grow this company in Louisiana and in Baton Rouge, we absolutely know is sending a signal around the country and around the world that we have a place where companies like IBM can locate. And so our economic development opportunities for more companies like that to be interested in and attracted to Baton Rouge is excellent. The other thing I want to emphasize on this is we've talked a lot about the power of our super region between Lafayette and New Orleans, and we really need to make sure that we talk about this as a win for all of South Louisiana and that the pride should attach to everyone throughout South Louisiana, even potentially statewide if you really want to think about the mobility of an IT worker to be attracted to a job like this is not from just one community, but it really can have an impact for technology companies throughout South Louisiana and around the state. And for those companies that are interested in being in Baton Rouge, they're going to look throughout South Louisiana, we think. And for companies like IBM, they've said that that's a very good thing. They love to know that they have a broader base of, you know, space that they geographic space that they can draw workers from. And the more companies that come, the more talent that comes, the more successful that they can be. So they have told us the same thing that EA told us before and many other companies. The more that you can get to come, the stronger we all will be because of the base of talent that it will bring and develop here. So they're very much encouraging us, and we are already continuing to aggressively work at computer science, software design, digital media type projects. We've said this, and I said this earlier in the year, we have more prospects in IT and in digital media and in software design this year than we had last year. And last year, we had more than the year before. It is an accelerating pace of companies in this space that are interested in being in Baton Rouge.
All right. Webb asks when the new Hampton will open downtown. It's obviously looking like it's getting close to completion. When's the start date? Do you know?
I don't. You'd have to talk to some of the folks in the hotel motel industry. That's not something we spend much
time. All right. Well, that's about a block away from the IBM location, isn't it? Not far.
It absolutely is. Yeah, I don't know the opening date.
Okay. Well, Baton Rouge has changed quite a bit over the last decade or so, and certainly over the last 5 years since you arrived as the head of the chamber.
It has, and one of the things that we like to talk about and that IBM reflected to us, a lot of the things that they are drawn to about the community. And many of the things that we see that have changed, not just in the 5 years I've been in this job. I moved back to Louisiana about 11 years ago. And in the period since moving to Baton Rouge in 2002, we've seen so many of the things that have really drawn companies like IBM here are investments that were conscious choices of the community. So if you think about the Manship Theater and the Shaw Center and the Shaw Center Development Complex, if you look at a lot of the capital buildings that have been built, the state building complexes downtown, the downtown landscaping project that's underway right now in, at the town square, so many of those projects, not just in the downtown area but around the Baton Rouge area, are ones that have been conscious choices by the state and by our community to build up. And they are really showing results for the quality of life and the visual aspects that attract companies to us. So we're pleased to see those changes actually help us, you know, sell the community as well.
Well, since we last talked, what's the latest on the CAT system?
You know, I had a feeling you wanted to egg me on about that.
What's going on?
Two things have happened since we last talked that we've been paying attention to. One, the board and staff have released the first look at a plan that they, you know, we've talked a lot about the importance of something that articulates a path to implementing what the Blue Ribbon Commission on Mass Transit released in 2011 as the design that made the most sense for a modern transit system for the community. In the plan that CATS has released, it effectively articulates the same principles and goals and structural goals that the Blue Ribbon Commission plan. It doesn't go into much detail about how they will get there. It doesn't articulate the number of routes. It leaves that important detail out. It does talk about wait times and improvement of wait times, and those things have been set as goals. However, it doesn't tell you how many routes they will have, you know, where the Blue Ribbon Commission plan was very specific. It doesn't talk about the number of express routes with the same specificity and rollout implementation plan. So we're still looking for more of those details to be released. We think that they are, we hope that they are working on them. They've also started talking about outsourcing of services, although they are not looking at the full privatization concept that some had talked about. They are talking about outsourcing a lot of the implementation of the new plan, and we're expecting in the coming weeks to be seeing a plan for what that might look like to do a contract for services, to release an RFP, look for a contractor to help them with the implementation. In general, we think that's a good thing that they're looking for outside support and that will help them on the path to getting there. But a big thing that's happened, Jim, is the board, the Metro Council, had a board member appointment. They just elected a new board member to the CATS board this week, and so we're all looking to see how that will play out.
All right, who's the new board member?
A fellow named Ken Perrette was nominated and appointed by the Metro Council this week.
Ann on Arlington. Hi, Ann. You're on with Adam Knapp.
Thanks. I want to ask Mr. Knapp, I'd heard or read that if the governor succeeds with his sales tax, that we will have the highest sales tax in the nation. Are you familiar with that assessment, and can you tell me something about it?
We are familiar with that assessment. That is a correct statement. The rate that is proposed would be the highest in the country in the rankings. We would be, however, on a business tax climate perspective, and again, BRAC has not made any endorsement of the plan as proposed. We have a tax committee that's looking at it, and there's a lot of varied sentiments, I'll say that, about what the plan looks like from a business standpoint. The sales tax being the highest in the country is one feature of sort of taxation on a business perspective that goes into overall business taxation, and the Tax Foundation, if you're familiar with it, there's an organization that looks at state business tax climates, and the Tax Foundation is a good source of information, not only about what you're asking about, how high the sales tax would be and what other states' sales taxes are, but also so the total basis of the taxation for businesses from a business perspective. It gives you a good perspective on the state's current tax climate, if you'd like to read some more about that.
Well, Adam Knapp, congratulations on a fine week. Hope you have a great holiday, and let's talk again soon.
Jim, this is a win for all of Baton Rouge and all of Louisiana. We hope that the community is as proud as we are for what this means for the future.
All right. Happy Easter, my friend.
To you, too.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And now we switch gears and go to our guest. And we're joined now by two prominent attorneys in Baton Rouge, both of whom practice law and are involved in pro bono work. The chair of the pro bono committee for the Baton Rouge Bar is Emily Zober, and the outgoing chair is Ken Mayo, and they are here to talk about their work. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hi, Jim.
Well, Ken, let's start with you. You've spent 27 years practicing law in this community, and you've been involved, as I just noted, in pro bono work. How does this work for people who need legal firepower and may not have the resources to get what they need?
Well, we're very proud of the pro bono project of the Baton Rouge Bar Association and the number of people we serve. This is a tremendous need, not only in our community, but across the country. Recent years have seen reductions in Legal Services Corporation funding for the main providers of legal services for the poor, like our local provider, Southeast mm-hmm. Louisiana Legal Services. And so as they've had to cut back in their services, our committee and our project helps fill the gap of the need for people who need civil legal services here in our community.
When you say civil legal services, if you're charged with murder, this isn't something that is available.
No, I mean that we have our public defender's offices, and they also have their funding problems.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem with funding for civil legal services is that a big chunk of that is funded by interest on lawyers' trust accounts. This is a fund that's managed by the Louisiana State Bar Foundation. Mm-hmm. And, of course, since 2008, with the drop in interest rates, that funding has also been cut. So we find ourselves in a time of great, great need for civil legal services. And like I said, we're very proud of the work that our committee and our project does to meet those needs.
And Emily Zober, I suspect that many people are unaware that this is available to them.
That's correct. And there are many different types of services offered here. We have actually, last year, we had over 2,800 hours volunteered by attorneys at a $150 an hour attorney rate. That would be a donation of almost $428,000 by attorneys in the Baton Rouge legal community last year for pro bono services. We offer locations at, we have a program called Ask a Lawyer, which is offered at Catholic Charities on Acadian and at public libraries. We have Thirst for Justice, which is offered on 3 to 5 in the afternoon, 2 days a week at St. Vincent de Paul. Ask a Lawyer is usually offered in the mornings on Wednesdays at Catholic Charities from 9 to 11:30. We have a financial literacy program, Wills for Heroes. We do wills for firemen, policemen, mm-hmm. That type of thing. And we do, this year, we started a pro bono self-help desk, which is located on the fourth floor of Family Court, where people who have questions on how to represent themselves can receive forms. We don't offer legal advice. We just offer resources, give people information and resources that, and we tell them to hire their own lawyer if they're able to.
If they're able to.
Right.
What if they're not able to?
Well, if they're not able to, they can, income-wise, if they qualify, they can go to Southeast Legal Services here in Baton Rouge. Or they can also, we do have a lawyer referral service with the Baton Rouge Bar.
Okay. Emily Zober, who is the chair of the pro bono project of the Bar Association, and the outgoing chair, Ken Mayo, you're talking about their services. And a lot of people have legal issues. We live in a litigious society. What are the most common inquiries that you get?
Well, family law composes about 80% of our cases. We are branching out more into other areas, bankruptcy, Social Security, landlord, tenant, contracts, wills, and small successions. We do get some property disputes.
But family law is 80% of it.
That's right.
People fighting over their kids.
Well, kids, community property, mm-hmm. Divorce issues.
But very often just people who have not been able to get divorced for all these years and they want to be able to move on with their lives. And a divorce proceeding is relatively simple, but getting that done without a lawyer can be a great challenge.
Well, and in this case, the one that you're describing, usually there are lawyers on both sides. And if one side has a high-powered attorney and the other side is going the pro bono route, is that necessarily a disadvantage, or can you hold your own without spending big dollars and getting big names to represent you?
Well, we're very proud of all of our lawyers who work in our program. Many of the pro bono family cases are taken by family law practitioners. So they're being represented by some of the best lawyers in Baton Rouge. So
yeah, in some cases you have some of the best known lawyers who participate in this project for how many hours? As many as they want?
Well, if you take a case that's contested, you really don't know how many hours are going to be involved in that. So that is a big donation of services by an attorney.
And you've done it yourself.
Right. We've done these cases.
So independent of family law, what are some of the other inquiries you get that are prominent?
More and more recently, we're seeing foreclosures and bankruptcies. So with the downturn in the economy, there was a much greater need for help with bankruptcy matters and with foreclosure defense.
Mm-hmm. Do people have a general appreciation of how the court system works, or do they often need some kind of indoctrination on what is involved when they're sued or they're about to sue somebody else?
I think most people who come in do not have a clear idea how the legal system works. But I think this is really a win-win situation for the clients who come in, the lawyer, and the courts, because it helps, basically it removes the fear that people have of the legal system. They come in and they receive information, and I think that really eases their fears about going to court.
And thank you, Emily Zober and Ken Mayo. And we will keep tabs on the pro bono services, which are vital to many in our community. And it is a worthy endeavor by members of the legal community in this area. Coming next on the show, we're slated to hear from Marina Adshade. Her book is Dollars and Sex. She explores the marketplace for sex and love using research, economic analysis, and humor to reveal how central the interplay of libido, gender, love, power, and economic forces is to the most important choices we make in our lives. She calls it sexonomics. We pause now for 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. 877-217-5757 is your number. And we resume our conversations this morning with a provocative author, Marina Adshade. Her book, Dollars and Sex, How Economics Influences Sex and Love. Good morning, Marina.
Good morning.
Some would say this is no great revelation, but what do you say about all the layers of activity involving our finances and our love life?
Well, you know, I'm obviously not the first person to talk about love and marriage as a market. We've been referring to it as a market for years. And so from that perspective, I don't think it is a great revelation. But I think that what the book brings is the work that's done by economists, other economists other than me, writing about things like online dating and marriage and how people hook up in the college environment, and bringing the actual numbers and statistics and the market relationships that we can observe and putting them together in a way that I think that is informative for people.
Well, how much does the financial situation of one or both parties in a relationship affect the evolution of that relationship in most cases?
Well, you know, that's a great question because, you know, one of the things that's really changed over time is that women have become much more educated than have men. So, for example, in the U.S., if you look at single people who are of marriageable age, like 24 to 40, you know, there's just a lot more educated women than there are men. I think for every 100 men, there's about 130 women who have a university degree. And so that's changing dynamics within relationships because now there's far more marriages that in which the wife is better educated than the man than there are marriages in which the man is better educated with the wife. So women are bringing in more higher incomes into their families. They're taking more control over the finances of the family. And that's really changing dynamics in relationships. And we've just started to see the beginning of this. I think this is something that's going to play out over the next 30 years.
297-5633, Marina Adshade, the guest. Her book is Dollars and Sex. It is a book that has created a lot of attention, as you might expect, talking about two things that are vital to our lives. Now, as far as women having the upper hand in education, that's no secret either, but after this original or initial attraction fades away and a woman's with a guy who's not as educated as she and doesn't have as much money as she does that in some way cause it to be a deal breaker at some point?
Well, you know, I think that for a lot of women, they're just unwilling to enter relationships with people who are less educated than themselves because they do worry that this is going to happen in the future. But the reality is the choice is never marry or marry somebody who's less educated than yourself. For a lot of women, this is the decision that they have to make. And so we have to compromise. And I think that eventually we will learn to compromise on this one thing. Actually, there's some interesting research that says that one of the ways that women are dealing with this is that they're actually marrying younger men than themselves. They're dipping into the pool below them. Actually, the way that men have for years, because high-income men and better-educated men have often, for a long time, been marrying younger women, and we're seeing a much bigger trend towards educated and high-income women marrying men who are much younger than themselves, like 5 to 10 years younger than themselves.
Uh-huh.
And so they're trading off. They might not get a guy who's educated, but they don't mind so much if they're going to get somebody who's a lot younger than them and, you know, has all the energy and everything they want in a partner.
Well, some would say that makes sense. Women, after all, do outlive men by five or 6 years on the average. And if they're making more money and they're more educated, why not choose a young one instead of some old guy who's fading into oblivion?
I don't think I would say fading into oblivion, but, yeah, I mean, it seems to be, it actually makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense for women, especially if they want somebody who's energetic, right? You know, who wants to go out and do all the things that they want to do. You know, there's another alternative here, too, right, is the possibility that men will, you know, start going to school at higher rates because they realize that, you know, they can marry better if they go to university or college. Actually, you know, there's good reasons to go to college outside of income, you know, that have to do with personal relationships. You know, for example, on college campuses, you know, there's so few men now that men get to call all the shots in the relationships, and that's one of the reasons why we've seen this movement to a kind of hookup culture on campuses and more casual sexual relationships. But also, they're more likely to get married. They're more likely to stay married because divorce rates are so much lower for people who have university degrees. So, you know, I'd like to think that we'll return to an equilibrium, as economists like to say. And that maybe with some of that imbalance in education will disappear over time.
So you're saying there's a relationship, Marina, between the rates of casual sex and an earning gap?
There is a relationship between the rates of casual sex and you know how many men are on the market relative to how many women are on the market. And you see this in high schools as well, right? So if in grade 12, there's often more girls in the class than there are boys. And when we look at the data and we see this, we find that you just get more promiscuity in high schools where there are more girls than there are boys. And that's because the boys get to call the shots because girls are competing for each other for relatively few boys. And actually, this happens in markets all through our lifetimes. One of the interesting things is that if you look at the seniors market, you know, you get the same thing. There's a lot more women on the seniors market than there are men. And so men are getting called some of the shots on that market as well, and that's one of the reasons why that group, people over the age of 55, are the group that has the fastest growing rates of sexually transmitted diseases. And that's in part because of the gender imbalance.
297-5633, some provocative information in dollars and sex. Well, the Supreme Court is weighing the merits of same-sex marriage. And whether it's a marriage between a man and a woman, or a woman and a woman, or a man and a man, one of the things you address in the book is marriage an opportunity to consume more goods and services?
Mm-hmm. You know, there's an interesting relationship, actually, between that idea that as marriage is a chance to consume more good services and same-sex marriage. And that's because marriage has really changed from the way that it used to be in the past. I mean, before we even started down the road of having the same-sex marriage debate, marriage has been evolving. And that's because in the past, marriage was, it was a chance to, well, in economic speak, to, you know, engage in trade, right? So you had one partner who could earn a lot of money on the marketplace. You had another partner who could spend her time at home taking care of children. So families were structured around that idea that, you know, one person stayed at home and the other person worked, and that was beneficial in terms of increasing, you know, the total income, basically, of the household. But, you know, we don't do that anymore. Most women work. 75% of women in the United States are working at any one point in time. And so the families aren't really doing that anymore. And so that kind of trade model of looking at marriage has disappeared. And so now marriage is more about enjoying your life together, essentially, and actually enjoying your life together in a less expensive way than you would as individuals. And so once marriage changed so that we no longer have women in the home, then you start getting more open to ideas of other different types of marriage, like same-sex marriage. You know, because in same-sex marriage, you know, there aren't the gains from trade as explicitly as you have in heterosexual marriage. But, you know, they can still take advantage of the shared consumption and the ability to spend your life with somebody, just increase your overall happiness and do it in a way that costs you less money because you don't have to spend as much money on housing and other things as well.
All right. Now, as far as the way we are evolving in the process of mating, when a couple goes out on a date, and let's say, for example, maybe the man and the woman earn about the same amount of money, who is expected to pick up the check at the end of the evening?
Yes. So, I mean, the bad news is that, you know, although many things have changed, not everything has changed. And I think the expectation is still that the man should pick up a check. But there is some interesting research that says that when the man picks up the check, even women think that he has more reason to believe that the woman's going to go home with him. And so there seems to be a relationship between paying the bill and expectations of sex at the end of the night. So we haven't changed so much that we've moved away from that. I always say to people on this is that I really do think that when women split the bill, or even when the women pay the bill themselves, they really do send a signal to men that they're not genuinely interested in them. And this is what it seems to be the behavior.
Here's a question from Holly. She asked, do women judge other women by the economic firepower of their spouses?
Oh, that's interesting. So, like, husband as a status symbol. I don't really have a clear answer to that. I mean, it seems to be that, one of the things that's happened over time is that we've come to care more about our relative status in terms of our income. And, that means that households are often competing with each other for, consuming in a very obvious way so that we can signal that we have a high income. And so families are doing this. And one of the things that we find is that this actually leads to high divorce rates. So if you're in a community where there's a lot of inequality, so some families have a lot of money and a lot of other families have very little, you get much higher divorce rates than in communities where there's very even income. And I think that's because people are unhappy when their spouses, and this could be true for men or women, are just not bringing in as much income as their friends' spouses. And so that creates, you know, disharmony in the household. So I think that Holly's probably right on that.
Mm-hmm. As much as we think we've evolved in relationships and have become more progressive, it is extremely rare to this day, isn't it, Marina, that a woman would be with a man who is less successful than she, doesn't earn as much money, perhaps is not as attractive as she is. Those factors ultimately do play a big impact in relationships, don't they?
Well, you know, 28% of American marriages are between a woman and a man where the woman has more education than the man. And that's compared to 19% where the man has more education than the woman. And I think that it's becoming increasingly more common that women have better education, higher incomes than their husbands. You know, it's not 50%, but it's definitely getting high. It's increasing over time. So we are moving away from that. But actually, the one thing, though, is I think that women are often more attractive than their husbands. And that's because men put such a premium on beauty. And so, you'll get men who have lots of money who aren't particularly attractive, but they're able to find themselves a wife who is much better, more attractive than themselves, because women can be compensated for their husband's poor looks with higher income. I know that sounds awful, but, you know, we can actually measure this.
Well,
because we see this in online dating, is that women will contact on online dating sites men who are not very attractive men just simply because they have a high income.
Yeah, but if you're a person, if you're a man and the woman in your life is making more money than you and is also more attractive, it would seem that she has options to get the heck out of Dodge and begin anew with some younger, sprucier version of yourself.
Yes, that's. That's not really. The market shouldn't work like that, right? So people shouldn't end up sorting out with people who are less attractive and have lower income than themselves. Because you're right, it essentially is not going to lead to a happy marriage. You know, this, one of the things, and I talk about this in the book when I talk about bargaining within marriage, is people's outside options actually matter. I'm not saying that every day you wake up and you think, am I going to leave you? What are my alternatives? But I think that we do care about what our outside options are. And people who have higher income than their spouses and people who are more attractive than their spouses, they do have more outside options. And so that gives them more say in the marriage on how decisions are made.
But after all these years of evolution, the sexual revolution, the gender equality, when it comes down to it, a man generally judges himself by his ability to be a breadwinner and take care of his family. And a woman often judges herself by her ability to stay young and vital and attractive.
You know, I agree with you that you hear this. But when you look at the next generation of men that are coming through who are, you know, at university age now and just below, you know, it's interesting to watch that so few of them go to university and so many of them, just don't appear to be particularly ambitious when it comes to their workplace decisions. And so you kind of wonder about that if this is such a big priority for men to be judged by how successful they are in their careers, why more men aren't going to university? Like, it's a bit of a mystery as to why you're getting such a big divide in university enrollment and graduation rates between men and women if men care so much about how they're perceived by others in terms of success in their careers.
Well, when you're 16 or 17 or 18, you're probably not thinking about the same kinds of things you are when you're 38 or 48 or 58.
Yeah, that's probably very true. You know, I say this, that, you know, parents should encourage their kids to go to school, not just because it's going to improve their income later on, but because, you know, there are lots of advantages in terms of personal relationships. People should be telling their 17-year-old sons, you should go to college because there's lots and lots of women there, and there's not a lot of men to compete with. You know, if you want your kid to go to school, maybe perhaps that's the best approach.
The book, Dollars and Sex, How Economics Influences Sex and Love. A question from another listener, Terry, asks, how much does physical beauty play in economic potential for women?
Well, you know, beauty is obviously important because men care far more about beauty than they do about a woman's income. And in fact, in this, the same online dating studies that I just mentioned a few moments ago, you can measure how much women are willing to trade off on looks versus income. But men are just totally unwilling to make that trade-off. So if they can choose between having a woman who's like in the top 10% in terms of looks, or a woman in the bottom 10%.
I'm sorry, we got to roll, but I think we get your point. Thank you, Marina. Have a good holiday, everybody. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.